This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And it's the 1st of March. February is finally over. Even though it's the shortest month, it extended its welcome by 28 days. We have a special day today. It is, of course, our Editor's Roundtable. We do this once a month, and that means we say hello and thank you, Dave Thompson, for hanging around the Capitol the way you do. He joins us from our microphone in Bismarck. He's our news director here at Prairie Public. Hi, Dave.
Hello, Doug.
And we greet Jack Zaleski, who's just back from his winter home in Vermont, where it's warmer.
Where winter won't kill you.
Jack is a columnist for Forum Communications, of course. He used to be the opinion page editor for the Forum of Fargo-Moorhead. And we have on the phone Tony Bender. Tony is a columnist as well and the publisher of the Ashley Tribune and the Wishick Star. Hello, Tony.
Hey, good to be here.
Okay, well, let's start with the winter that will not go away. We're a little concerned here on the eastern edge of the state, Dave, because there are some flood forecasts that have been changed just recently.
That's right.
And yes, we're in a critical month now. We just started it.
And I see that the Corps of Engineers is starting to try to let some more extra water out of some of the upstream dams on the Red and its tributaries to try to mitigate it a little bit. But the figures I saw, 85% to 90% chance of a flood.
Yeah.
That's why I'm – because the snow has been just almost relentless.
Well, of course, when they say that, we're used to floods, and we're used to flood levels in Fargo, Moorhead, and Grand Forks and all the way up the stem of the Red River. And at this point, I don't think they're looking at anything that approaches the record flood that Jack and I remember from 97 and 2009, yeah, the ones that were so devastating to so many people. That said, we do remember the weather conditions, and this mm-hmm. is an important month.
Yeah, and the thing is, you know, driving around, I was shocked when I got back to Fargo after a couple of months in Vermont and started driving around Fargo and Moorhead in the area and saw how much snow is piled up. Flying in, it was incredible. It looked like the Arctic because, you know, usually this time of the winter, even if there is a lot of snow, the fields are blown, mm-hmm. are blown clear. But flying in Monday afternoon, the fields are solid snow, solid white. So it does look like, you know, the Arctic. And it's there's a lot of water out there. And depending on how it melts, how much snow we get between now and the melt, will determine the severity of a flood. The good side of all this is that since 1997, Fargo and Moorhead and other cities that have been prone to flooding along the Red and its tributaries have done an awful lot to improve protection, whether by pumps and levees and dikes and other means. And so Fargo is protected now to a pretty high level and certainly higher than what we saw in 97 and 2009. So and there's more capacity of to flow through on the main stem because so many, some 800 homes, I think, properties have been removed from the floodplain. And so water can rise into those areas. So a lot has been done. And so right now it doesn't appear, you know, we'll get what they might call major flooding because the river will rise to a certain level, but not high enough to cause great damage to the city.
Now, the concern is that there is a lot of snow out there. It's
yes.
particularly heavy in the areas that feed into the Red River mm-hmm. Upstream, which would be down by Wahpeton and Breckenridge and those areas there. So this is Cross Your Fingers Month. There's also a fair amount of snow and a little concern in the Devil's Lake Basin, and you know that area pretty well. You used to be the editor of that paper.
Yeah, there's a lot of snow up there, and, and you know, that's they call it a closed basin because it rarely naturally flows, but there are outlets now. The outlets flow into the Cheyenne. There's a lot of snow in the Cheyenne River drainage, and so that all comes down toward you know, Lisbon mm-hmm. in that area, makes the turn and comes up toward Fargo and West Fargo. But in the Devil's Lake Basin itself, the word is I hear from my friends in that area, there's a lot of snow. They expect the lake to rise.
Well, and of course, we have this unique issue here with the Red River. It flows north, which means that when the thaw starts, it's flowing into ice, which backs it up and makes the flood that much worse. Dave, the Missouri also has an icing problem occasionally.
It does because of the, you know, there are bends in the river. There's one just right south of the Bismarck-Mandan area, and that is prone to have ice jams. I know the Corps is watching it, the National Guard is watching it, city officials on both sides of the river are watching it. So far, so good, but, you know, this could break loose very fast. Should we get a warm-up? Fortunately or unfortunately, I don't see anything in the forecast for several days yet on that.
Uh-huh. Well, and the frost is pretty deep because we've had a cold winter, and that does remind me of 96, 97. That was a cold winter as well. Tony, are there any bodies of water in the Sauerkraut Triangle that you're watching?
Well, there probably will be one in my basement. No, we have, as they've been moving snow around in the small towns, residents are getting very concerned about these big piles of snow, and so at least in Ashley, they're really making a concerted effort to try to haul out as much snow as possible to mitigate any basement issues, which I suspect my sump pumps will be running. Just looking at the snow that I've got out here in my backyard. I live out in the country, and I would say we've been here for 20 years. I would say this is probably, in the top three as far as accumulated snow in my backyard.
Well, you mentioned those snow banks, and that is a traffic hazard right now in the Fargo-Moorhead area. They've moved a lot of snow out, but there's a lot of snow yet to be moved out. And you can see cars occasionally peeking past a snowbank trying to see if they're taking their lives into their hands by going into an intersection.
Well, I tell you, I'm really worried about Bender's backyard. CNN will be out there to do it.
Yeah, get that satellite truck out there somehow. Well, let's move.
Give me a break here, I don't experience the Fargo flood, So look, this is what I'm dealing with. I'm sorry it did not meet your tragic proportions.
It's just that big city snobbery up here. You know how that goes.
Our floods are better than your floods.
Well, let's move on to a story of national significance, where a North Dakotan got a brief moment on the national stage, and that was North Dakota Representative Kelly Armstrong. He was among the minority membership of the House Oversight and Reform Committee when Michael Cohen testified earlier this week, and quite a show it was. Any reviews, Dave, about Kelly Armstrong's performance from the people you know in Bismarck?
Well, mostly because that I'm tied to the legislative session. Not a lot of people got a chance to watch it. I talked to a couple who did watch a bit of it, and they said that he held his own very well. And I know that the Grand Forks Herald has editorialized that he did very well with that. But I personally have not seen it. I was covering a hearing of some sort.
I don't even
remember what the bill was.
Kelly Armstrong's a pretty good guy. He had a good reputation in the legislature. I think people liked him. He was able to work Democrats on some pieces of legislation that was necessary. From my perspective, I think he was an embarrassment at the hearing in Washington. He didn't have an original thought. He didn't ask any questions. He followed the playbook of his chairman, and it wasn't. I don't think it was a high point in his career, and I hope he understands that.
Well, there was a strategy, it seemed, on the minority side of that committee. And this is, of course, it's now a Democrat House. It used to be a Republican House. And that was to call a convicted liar, Michael Cohen, a liar as many times as they could. But Cohen himself called the president of the United States a racist, a con man, and a cheat. And he laid out some facts that are likely going to be researched very carefully. So this story is it's epic, it's 2 years long now, and it's probably going to last a couple more at least, and maybe for the Trump family for a long time after that. So stay tuned, I guess. Dave, we have been looking at this state budget. You and I have talked about it over and over. Mm-hmm. This revenue forecast coming up in March is pretty important, isn't it?
It's very important, and that will set the tone for the spending decisions that are going to be made in that second part of the three-period hockey game that we call the legislature. And the reason I say it's three periods is because you've got the House, the original houses have the first period. They look at their bills in the second period. The other House takes a look. But in the third period, you've got the all-important conference committees. And that's the thing to watch. What I'm hearing from Some legislators, they seem to be at least quietly confident that the numbers are going to look a little better than they did back in December, and that might help things along. Right now, the legislature will say they're $800 million below water, you know, basically upside down.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't take into account this SIF fund, which they've used a lot. As a matter of fact, one WAG called it General Fund 2.
And what is that?
That's the Strategic Investment and Infrastructure Fund.
Okay.
But SIF has been used to shore up another number of other budgets, such as some of these other rainy day funds are out there. So I was talking to somebody from the majority party in the Senate who deals with budgets, and he says, you know, right now, if we had to go and do what we normally do with a SIF fund, we're going to be okay. So it shows that there is some flexibility, I guess.
Tony, do you have a parrot in your room?
No, I don't. Were you hearing chirping?
No, it was more than a chirp.
I'm not hearing it here.
Okay, no. Very good. Well, while we're talking about the budget and revenue and all of that, Dave, the oil production seems to be keeping up.
It is keeping up. There's some worry that the next numbers, which I think they're going to be released in March, and I think they're for January numbers, it might ratchet back a little bit because the winter has been kind of harsh. It'll be worth it, you know, to take a look at January and February numbers. It probably won't be record-setting like we've seen for the last several months. But, you know, it's still well above a million barrels of oil a day.
And Dave, isn't that usually the pattern, especially if there's bad weather in the winter?
Absolutely.
That there's a little bit of a downturn from what would have become highs, nice highs, so that ratchets down a little bit because of the weather, then cranks up again in the spring. So,
right, and that's what I think everybody's expecting that again.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, there is, I think, a bill that's going through the legislature that has passed the House, Dave. You reported this over a week ago, Operation Prairie Dog. That's something that provides some infrastructure funding, doesn't it?
It does. Now, this infrastructure funding is basically for cities, counties, and townships. And it really is targeted at the entire state. You know, for the last few bienniums, there's been a lot of focus on infrastructure in the Bakken, and rightfully so. You've got, you know, heavy trucks and things like that that are going across those roads, and there's people moving there to take the oil jobs, and they needed streets, curbs, gutters, things like that, and some upgraded, and they put in some bypasses. But this Prairie Dog is designed for basically the rest of the state, and it's going to be a permanent source, and it's going to be a bucket for oil tax money, but it's going to be a permanent source for funding for these cities and counties and townships that are really outside the oil patch area.
And in your story, you reminded us all that the Republicans, who are the supermajority in the legislature, have factions they have to deal with. One of those is represented by Rick Becker in the House. He's dismissed this as a get reelected bill.
Right. And let me just tell you that I'm going to preview a story we're going to have for Monday. That has angered the majority leader in the Senate. Let's just put it that way. He had a very interesting comment, and he said, I want this on the record that this is not a re-election bill. So there's, you know, it's a point where tempers get a little testy at times.
Not a good idea to get Senator Wardner angry.
No. And you know Senator Wardner, like we all do.
He
showed a little bit of anger there, but, you know, he's really a good-natured person. He works very hard for the good of the state. But, you know, that got to him, and I understand why.
We're holding our editor's roundtable. We do this once a month. You just heard Dave Thompson and Jack Zaleski. We've got Tony Bender on the phone, and we'll be back to talk about what the headlines have been telling us in just a moment.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we spent a second week in conversation with President Thomas Jefferson talking about the Constitution.
Jefferson was not at the Constitutional Convention in 1787, but he was, in a sense, the bibliographer of it, and he had extensive commentary about it once he received finished copies of it in the autumn of 1787 in Paris.
And we also acknowledge that in the end, we as citizens still have the power to change it. So join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we have our editors' roundtable assembled. Dave Thompson in Bismarck, Jack Zaleski with me in Fargo, and Tony Bender on the phone in Ashley or Wishing? Oh, outside of Ashley, right?
Well, actually, in Venturia, smack dab in the middle.
Okay, very good. how careful of you. That's right. This is something that is interesting. I think you've written about this, Tony. There's a Senate measure to put more requirements on initiated constitutional amendments. Do you want to weigh in on that?
Well, you know, I certainly understand wanting to raise the bar. But we've had I think there's an accumulated mistrust here that, you know, in a lot of circles of the legislature, and so this may make some sense, but I'm not sure about the timing, because they seem to be, you know, they seem to have dragged their feet on medical marijuana, although that is a reality today. But also, you know, some members of the legislature are not really embracing Measure One, and so I think you can make the argument that the bar ought to be higher, but I'm not so sure the timing is right.
Yeah, because, well, let's talk about Measure One. That's the Ethics Commission that was mandated by that constitutional amendment that made it.
Now, there are two bills, I think, the Senate bill is the one I think that the proponents of the measure favor. It's had been tweaked a little bit, but that looks like the bill that at least honors the intent of the voters. The House bill, I think, is this right, Dave? The House bill had a bunch of exceptions and crazy things in it that would have essentially gutted the intent of the measure,
right?
Of the amendment. So I don't know if that's going anywhere. But
well, it has passed the House. The Senate's passed the Senate. Mm-hmm. Now the other chamber will take a look at both of them. And I talked to the leadership early on, and they basically said they wanted to try to get the best of all worlds that they could put into a bill, but there's one other thing that if you read Measure One, mm-hmm. they said, you know, you can study it for a couple of years as you're writing rules, and the House kind of is writing the rules now.
Yeah, yeah. My fear is that they're going to, and there seems to be an inclination out there with some of the other kinds of legislation that are being talked about, like messing with the requirements for constitutional amendments, and then the ethics measure. An inclination out there to dismiss, if you will, what the voters said and what the voters you know want and this sort of thing. And I think Senator Wardner is one of those. He doesn't like the ethics bill. He doesn't like the ethics measure at all. But he understands, I think, that the voters said what they said.
Right, and he's been kind of helping to shepherd the Senate version
of bills. Yeah, that's right. So I think they need to be careful here. They need to be very careful because I think the ethics measure in particular resonates among people across party lines and you know, across incomes and everything else. So people like to know what their government's doing and who's paying for it. And so I think they need to be very careful here. They're going to end up on something's going to end up on the ballot again that's going to embarrass them.
Tony, there's a bit of a paradox here in a way too, because the people have spoken, and they spoke pretty loudly and clearly, and this issue has been batted around for many sessions at the legislature, whether there should be an ethics oversight of the legislature, and where you are, I mean, where I am, I can tell you that most people think that, you know, there should be oversight. But give us your two cents on this one.
Well, you know, locally, I'll tell you that, you know, in McIntosh County, they did not favor it. I mean, they saw it as a liberal plot, I think, generally, which of course, they pretty much see a lot of things that way. But here's, you know, this is, you hit on a good point there, because this has been discussed. There have been, you know, issues, you know, regarding marijuana, this issue. And the legislature has had opportunity to be proactive, to have their ear to the ground and say, you know, this is coming. Why don't we do this in a manner that, you know, that we feel good about, instead of having something, you know, in their minds shoved down their throats? But they waited too long, and now, you know, they got some things that they're not happy with. And I don't think it would have happened if they had been more proactive and truly tried to make things more transparent.
Yeah, and you know, there's a long tradition here now. I forget how far back it goes. Dave might know, of initiative and referral and being able to amend the Constitution by ballot. Mm-hmm. And I think it's cherished and valued and protected by the voters of North Dakota, by the culture of the voters of North Dakota. It's something that we value because, you know, whether they think so or not, sometimes the legislature gets it wrong. And or they're mm-hmm. so tied into some sort of an ideological vice wrapped in that way that they miss the sentiment that's out there among the voters. And they've done that several times over the last few decades. So messing with that in any way, violating what was passed or trying to make it harder to do it is a risky business for the legislature. They need to step back and take a look at what they seem to be trying to do.
Yeah, and this latest bill, if I could just, this latest bill that we covered this past week, the Senator Unruh's bill, basically raises the bar for the number of signatures you need, basically says each county needs to be represented, and you have to submit them 240 days before the election, and then it has to pass with a 60% vote. Now, I thought that was familiar, and I believe that has been tried before, that somebody's introduced that before, but it's failed in trying to get something that every county has to have a signature on these petitions.
Well, Tony mentioned another issue that was supported by voters, and now almost 2.5 years later, the first medical marijuana dispensary has opened in Fargo, and there is still talk about working on decriminalization of possession of marijuana. So this is still a big issue as well.
Yes, it is. And the House has turned down the Shannon Roars Jones bill on decriminalization, you know, making it a fine instead of a misdemeanor for possession of a certain amount of marijuana. However, she says that may come back in the Senate.
And yeah, the vote was very close.
It was very close.
Yeah.
But it may come back in the Senate. It might be amended on to another bill. And
so
we'll have to watch and see what happens on that.
Now, these dispensaries are going to open up in other areas of the state as well. But this is a very highly regulated business as it now stands in North Dakota.
Mm-hmm. It is. And, you know, Fargo got the first dispensary. Bismarck's got one that should be opening, I think, fairly soon.
April, I believe. They're shooting for that one, yeah.
And the others, I guess the firms have been decided. They just haven't released who the firms are who are going to be having the dispensaries. So it is coming to fruition, not as fast as the proponents had hoped it would, but it's finally getting there.
Well, I think one of the problems with this is whether or not what medical providers are going to sign off on these prescriptions or these, you know, the authorization to get access to this. And still out there is I guess I haven't heard whether Sanford, which of course has a huge footprint in North Dakota, is going along with this.
That's a good question. I thought there was some movement in that direction, but I could be wrong.
So. Well, I think part of what we hear from the medical community is that while people there's an awful lot of anecdotal evidence, if you will, that medical marijuana in some forms really helps people, and it's hard to deny that, especially when you see some of the testimony that came with the attempted legislation in North Dakota over the years. But there's also, I think, a body of thought in the medical community that there is not enough research, not enough real research, you know, to prove the efficacy of some of these substances that are marijuana-based. And so doctors, given the federal law as it stands, are a little bit reluctant, I think, to maybe jump in with both feet right away. We'll see. You know, my guess is the new place open in Fargo is going to be very, very busy very quickly.
Well, we'll pick up more of our editor's roundtable. And you just heard Jack Zaleski. We've got Dave Thompson in Bismarck. And by phone, we've got Tony Bender. But first, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A Grand Forks police say a sixth grade girl from Schrader Middle School ran from a white male who tried to lure her into his minivan. Authorities say around 3:35 on Thursday afternoon, the girl was walking home on the 3300 block of South 10th Street. The man told the girl that her mother was at a hospital ER and she needed to come with him immediately. The student knew it wasn't true and ran home, notifying a family member who contacted police. The man did not follow the student. Police are looking for the suspect, described as 50 to 60 years old with gray and white hair and a similar colored beard or goatee, wearing a tan leather jacket and blue jeans and a white baseball cap with black lettering. The minivan is described as red with clothes piled in the rear and having South Dakota license plates. Police Lieutenant Brett Johnson says anyone with information on the incident is asked to contact the Grand Forks Police Department.
Obviously, we'll have extra patrols around the schools. We have sent out the information to other law enforcement agencies in the region to make sure that they're also keeping their eyes peeled. And then obviously the public schools will also be taking extra precautions.
Johnson says police have received no reports of similar incidents. If the legislature were to pass and voters approve a two-board system for higher education, what becomes of the chancellor of the university system?
In the Constitution in North Dakota, there's no word called chancellor. It's called the higher education administrator.
Governor Burgum has been pushing for a multi-board system and asked the Senate Education Committee to amend the measure to expand the existing board, replacing it with two boards.
We would envision in a two-board model, the board of trustees, if you will, they would be the ones that would be doing the hiring. They would be the ones that would be evaluating their presidents. And so while there would still be a need for a centralized higher education administrator, it'd be different than the hybrid model we're trying to use today with the chancellor in between the board and the presidents.
The House earlier rejected the two-board model. If either the two-board or expanded board models pass the legislature, it would have to go to a public vote in 2020. And record snowfall across much of Minnesota is leaving many dairy farmers in a lurch. Lucas Shostrom is with the Minnesota Milk Producers Association. He says hundreds have had to dump milk because the tanker trucks couldn't get through to pick it up. He says roofs on 20 barns have collapsed under heavy snow, and that has injured or killed some cows. Snowstrom says the weather has disrupted the routines of some farmers who have been struggling with low prices for years.
That's the biggest thing on farms is keeping things the same. And, of course, roof caving in is not the same and may keep cows away from feed or may keep cows away from being milked. That can really disrupt their day and make them sick.
Shostrom says the collapse of a barn roof in Olmsted County, Minnesota, caused a fifth-generation family farm to sell its herd. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we have our editor's roundtable in session. Jack Zaleski with me in Fargo, Dave Thompson in Bismarck, Tony Bender in Venturia on the phone. Let's talk about this sports betting bill that passed the House on a second try. Dave, you reported on this last week. This is an interesting wrinkle in North Dakota.
It is, and remember, it was a New Jersey case that the circuit court, I believe, decided that, you know, hey, it's happening already, so states can't prevent you from doing it, and now North Dakota wants to legalize it. And yes, there were two competing bills. One would basically say the charities would be in charge of it, and you can bet on all kinds of sports, including college sports. The other bill that did fail was just limiting it to pro sports, but it did not say specifically it was going to be the charities who were going to be involved with this. It did pass on the second try around, and it did pass by only a handful of votes. I don't know what the appetite in the Senate is for it, but there's going to be a hearing next week. We'll have to find out.
I mean, in practical terms, Dave, sports betting, legal or illegal, in North Dakota, it's going on, isn't it?
It is. Mm-hmm. I bet it is.
Has been forever.
Yeah, big time. So.
And, of course, if anybody's gone to Las Vegas and been at a casino recently, you know that there's a large area of those casinos where that's what people are watching and they're betting on it and the odds are changing and all that kind of stuff is going on.
Dave, does this bill have a revenue component to it for the state?
It does. Mm-hmm. There is a taxation on that the state's going to get cut. Mm-hmm. There definitely is.
Yeah.
And it's similar to the gaming taxes that are paid now.
Yeah, okay.
So that NDSU-UND football game this fall is going to be a revenue generator, you think, if this passes
governor
signs
yes.
it? Yeah.
Well, nothing's for sure because it was a close vote in the House. As I said, I don't really know what the Senate's appetite is for it, but maybe they figure we might as well get the revenue here because, you know, a lot of this is being done online anyway.
Well, Tony, we know there's no betting where you are.
Well, no, not since Billy Kretschmar passed away.
So you knew the bookie personally, huh?
Look, Billy, former representative from Venturia, of course, we kept him in our fantasy football league because we needed an attorney. Look, it's not that I ever won anything. I just write it off as a donation every year.
I'm kind of curious, though, whether the NCAA has a position on this. I mean, shades of Boston College and stuff like that.
So far, the NCAA has been kind of quiet. Mm-hmm. I wonder if they're going to be sending representatives to the Senate hearing that's going to be held this upcoming week.
Okay.
I think it's worth watching. And that's one of those bills that, you know, sometimes might get lost in the crush of the other things that are going on. And there's an awful lot on the legislature's plate. And some of the futures of some of these things, we'll just call it up in the air at this point.
The Roosevelt Library has mm-hmm. been hotly debated.
One of them.
Uh-huh. It's not funded for now. This is one of Governor Burgum's pet projects. Is this going to have some life, do you think?
I believe it will. You know, there's some talk. There was some talk in, I think, Day's reporting that said Senator Wardner's a little concerned about the budget projections, the financial uh-huh. projections in March, and if there's a downturn, that the funding for the library would be in jeopardy. We don't know that. It could be that there'll be more money than is expected, and I always find that argument ridiculous. If they don't fund the library, they're going to fund something else. History shows they don't do that. You know, that's not the way it works. But
exactly.
It never works that way.
We hear the story. You know, we can't do this until we get every homeless vet off the street.
Right.
And once the issue is dead, does anything ever happen? Is there any legislation to actually make a move to do that? So, yeah, it's a disingenuous argument.
Yeah, it is all the time. But in this case, I think there's support, broad support, east to west, north to south, for this for the library in Madour and near the entrance to the National Park. It certainly has support nationally.
Yes, it does. I interject in here?
Yes, sir.
I have to go back to a little bit of history. And I think you'll all remember this. Remember the legislature passed that contingency appropriation that if the general fund got to a certain level, then Dickinson State University would get money to start remodeling the Stockton Library on campus to turn it into a Theodore Roosevelt Library. Well, the initial report said, yes, we've got the money. And remember, the then Governor John Hoeven went to Dickinson. They held a little celebration. A couple days later, oops. And, you know, in a way, you kind of feel a little sorry for Dickinson, because Dickinson State has done a lot of job with the digitization of some of the records and some of the mm-hmm. documents. It's done a very good job. And, you know, you might think that they should be in the running for the library, but the board decided that it might be a better draw if you built a library and museum in Medora, because it fits very well with the Theodore Roosevelt Park right there.
And I think that's proving to be the case. That's been selling, you know, among private donors. You know, some of the heavy hitters, not only here in North Dakota but around the nation, really like the idea of the location in Roosevelt Country, where he was, where the ranch was, where the park is. And so I think that's selling a lot better than if it were on the campus of Dickinson State University.
And I think some of the visionaries out there see this sort of natural kind of path from the Black Hills mm-hmm. up in, you know, to North Dakota's Medora and to see Teddy Roosevelt's museum, not just a rock on the side of a hill, you know.
You heard that from Governor Burgum, who said, hey, look at how many visitors go down to the faces. You know, maybe we can get some of the traffic up here. And he's betting that you will.
Well, this is a big investment. But, of course, look what the Black Hills have done for South Dakota. Let's talk about another issue that has been around and around and around and probably will keep coming back until it's resolved. And that's the House has rejected, you had this over a week ago, Dave, anti-discrimination bill for sexual orientation. Mm-hmm. This is one of those social issues that just isn't going to go away, and will it have any life left in it this session, do you think?
This session, I think the book is closed on it. That's the way I see it right now. Unless something, you know, really catastrophic happens and they get a delayed bill introduced into one of the sessions. But, you know, it was tried two different bills. One would have included people who are transgender. One did not. The one that did not, the sponsor said the reason she did that is to try to get something passed and to get going down the road, and that didn't work either. There is still a segment who would like to say there is not discrimination. They have not heard of it. They don't see it, and they're just not inclined to have an anti-discrimination law on this particular issue on the books.
Yeah, well, it's really interesting that it didn't just get beat, it got hammered. I mean, yes, it was 70 to 20 or something like that?
That's right.
And so it looks like the margin or the sentiment has even hardened more on this issue than it has been in the past. And I think I agree with Dave. I don't think it's going anywhere.
Well, when you look at statistics nationwide, not in North Dakota, because I don't think anybody's really keeping them, about 20% of all hate crimes that are reported involve LGBTQ people.
And I think it's important that that phrase you said, Doug, that are reported. There's more.
Yeah. That's so true. Again, I think this is coming back over and over again, like all these others keep coming back until there's a resolution.
I would almost guarantee it'll be back in 2 years.
Okay, moving on to the ongoing debate that seems endless about higher ed governance. Governor Burgum has now, just today, you posted this, or yesterday, I should say, Dave, that Governor Burgum has pushed for a multi-board system for higher ed governance because there was a movement to make just a larger single board, I think.
Right. And take a look at the history of this. You know, the task force was met 11 times. They first decided to recommend a three-board plan. So each of the universities, the UND and NDSU, would get their own board. Then the rest would be under one board. Then they made it a two-board plan for the two research universities, the rest. That failed. And now in the Senate, they've got a resolution to expand the current board from 8 members to 11 members. Governor Burgum goes before the hearing and says, would you amend it and make it a multi-board thing again? I think the people of North Dakota, and that's, I'm trying to paraphrase him here, he said, the people of North Dakota, I believe, would like and would vote for a two-board plan. I don't know how that goes, but there seems to be, I don't know if there's really a lot of appetite to go to a two-board plan.
There probably isn't, although, you know, I think I'm thinking back on my newspaper. I think we supported a two-board plan for a long, long time that would have a board for the two research universities and then a board for the other schools.
Mm-hmm.
That's similar to the University of Minnesota and the Minnesota
right.
State system.
The Minsky system.
And you know, it really is the functions and the purposes and the management of the two big universities is really different. The two research universities is different from the other schools. And so there could be some benefit in that. I thought the governor's three-board plan was, you know, just adding three layers of bureaucracy for reasons that didn't seem to make sense at the time. But you know, he still believes that's the way to go.
Mm-hmm.
Two-board plan makes sense because you can make the case that the way the research universities operate and their focus and function are far different from the smaller schools.
In Minnesota, they do have, of course, the University of Minnesota is its own separate system.
Yep.
That's a gigantic research institution. And the rest of the 2 and 4 year colleges mm-hmm. and universities work together as what is called Minnesota State now. It used to be called Minsky.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the model there. And there, every state's got some sort of wrinkle on this. But Tony, to me, Jack mentioned the bureaucracy, and that's sort of how it would, I think, reads to people on the street here. You know, everybody gets upset about a university, you know, supposedly, allegedly spending money in an inappropriate way. But I don't know that people are consumed with interest in how it's governed.
Well, I've been sitting here and I've been thinking about it, and I'm not, you know, I've not been anywhere near one of those boards, but the whole concept of creating more government in a state that, you know, I mean, I think, you know, per capita has more government than than probably any other state.
Yeah.
And so maybe I just don't see the advantages, but you know, I'd like to think that a board could walk and chew gum at the same time and administrate, you know, UND and NDSU and Dickinson State and Dickinson University. That's my gut reaction, but I don't know that. I mean, I could be proven wrong.
Well, we'll see, because this thing continues to raise its head. And there was another interesting wrinkle today, Dave, because you reported that the governor hinted that if there were the two-board system, there'd be no chancellor.
Right. He said, and he's right, that in the Constitution it says there should be a commissioner of higher education, not a chancellor. And he said, if you listen to more of the story, what he's saying is that the boards should be the one to hire and fire and evaluate the university presidents. Right now, the chancellor does the evaluation.
Well, did that get Chancellor Haggerott's attention, do you think?
I think it has. And
well, isn't Dave, wouldn't that be sort of going back to where we were when, I forget the last chancellor, Larry, he's in Minnesota now.
Larry Isaac?
Yes,
Larry
that's
Isaac.
Who it was.
Yeah, yeah, and that would sort of be going back to
right.
That system.
It's been kind of a, you know, circuitous route, if you want to put it,
yeah.
Or maybe a curved road, the
yes.
way things have been
yeah.
going about the evaluations. And I know that there is some unrest about the evaluation of the president at UND.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's manufactured or what is going on with that, but there's some unrest there. And,
you know, even with all these problems that the system has had over the last few years with chancellors and other campus problems and whatnot, every time these things go on the ballot or are discussed in some detail and get to the ballot, the voters are very reluctant, you know, over history, to mess with the system that was put in place to allegedly to depoliticize the higher education system. They just don't want to do it. I guess if this came to a yeah, what was the last one on the ballot that got fried?
It was that was the Al Carlson proposal to have three elected commissioners.
Right,
believe.
Right. Yes. So you know, there's that reluctance. It seems to be built into the North Dakota higher education psyche, and when these things come up on the ballot and want to make significant changes in the system, they get rejected. So you know, the legislature might want to consider that.
Let's move on to another topic here. Dave, you reported this week that on a split decision, the Public Service Commission had approved siting for a solar power project in Cass County. This would be a sizable project.
Yeah, 200 megawatt project on 1,600 plus acres in Cass County. It's basically west of Fargo. That is a fascinating project because there's this rule that the Public Service Commission adopted. It's about prime farmland. And the objection to approving the siting project for this came from Commissioner Crispin, who said, we really need to revisit that rule before we make an exception for this. He considered it an exception. The other two commissioners said, no, we've looked at it. And if you look at prime farmland, 1,600 acres, although it's a big chunk of land, is really not even 1% of the prime farmland of the Red River Valley. So that was their argument.
Yeah, and this whole business about prime farmland seems to be a canard to me sometime. I mean, when you look at what's happened in cities like Fargo, Grand Forks, Bismarck, to a great extent also, and see how much prime farmland, pasture and whatnot, has been eaten up by development that the PSC, of course, has no control over, shopping malls, housing districts, on and on and on, highways, power lines. Suddenly there's this great concern about 0.17% of prime farmland mm-hmm. in the Red River Valley, which, by the way, will still be farmed.
That's right. Mm-hmm. It will still be farmed.
Yes.
Well, I had an interesting conversation with a person who works in the South Dakota Public Broadcasting News and Information area, and she was saying that the South Dakota legislature, which is also in session now, was advancing legislation that would really create barriers for alternative energy development in that state, mm-hmm. that wind power and solar power.
Well, I wonder where that's coming from.
Well, it's intriguing because wind power is pretty important in North Dakota right now, isn't it, Tony?
Well, it is. We've got one of the largest wind farms. Well, we've got a couple around here. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me, when we're talking about this prime farmland, made this such a sacred cow. But doesn't it come down to the most productive use of the land? Hmm. And if that's a if that's renewable energy, which, like it or not, here in North Dakota, is the direction things are going, then I don't have a problem with that. It just seems like an unnecessary hurdle.
Well, North Dakota has this embarrassment of riches in terms of energy. They've got lots of wind. They're looking at solar now, but certainly oil and gas and coal-fired power plants. Although,
right, and it's really interesting because you mentioned coal-fired. Heskett plant north of Mandan is going to be now natural gas entirely soon.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be a peaking plant because that's the way the economy is going in energy these days.
Yeah.
Well, let's finish with an interesting discussion. A friend of all of ours who's occasionally on Main Street and other venues of broadcasting around our area, Jim Shaw, is, of course, a big fan of Patriots Day. He's from Massachusetts.
He is.
And
he
Dave, is. You just filed this today. There is a bill that would add Patriots Day as a North Dakota holiday.
It's a North Dakota holiday, but not one where they'd force businesses or schools to close, but as a kind of a remembrance day saying, hey, the third Monday in April is what they're proposing, and it's Representative Austin Shaw from West Fargo who's got the bill.
And a friend of Jim Shaw's
and
as well.
A friend of Jim Shaw's, exactly. And, you know, the military came out in force, military veterans and also the National Guard came out in force to testify in favor of that bill. It easily passed the House. Now it's in the Senate, and it might be on its way to the governor's desk soon.
Well, I would be in favor of a Patriots Day on the second Tuesday in November, frankly.
I'm not sure if our friend Jim means Patriots Day as in the Patriots who founded the country and all that stuff, or if he means the football team in Massachusetts.
Which wins far too many games.
You know, well, part of the argument, if I'm right on this, is that they're saying, you know, our kids today need to be reminded of, you know, history and civics and things like that. Mm-hmm. And I keep thinking, why aren't we teaching civics in school then? I mean, is that something that we're even funding?
Well, the South Dakota legislature actually is looking at a bill to require that as part of the school curriculum. But we have run out of time, gentlemen. We'll see whether the North Dakota legislature picks up that idea. You just heard Tony Bender. He's the publisher of the Ashley Tribune and the Wishick Star, and we have with me in my Fargo studio, we've got Jack Zaleski, who's a columnist for Forum Communications, and Dave Thompson, our stalwart, is always there in Bismarck. Thank you, Dave.
You bet.
More Main Street in a moment.
On the next episode of Threshold...
The health of the ice cover is not very good.
The loss of Arctic sea ice is bad news for all kinds of creatures, including humans. But some people are finding an upside.
There will be definitely new opportunities for investors, new opportunities for the global value chain thinking in here.
Arctic sea ice is melting and Arctic business is booming. Learn more on Threshold.
Threshold, this week's Prairie Public Presents, coming up Sunday afternoon at 5 Central, 4 Mountain. Support for Dakota Datebook is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds. And by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck, producing reliable electricity. Basin Electric operates generation stations in North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, and Wyoming, including wind farms in North and South Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 1st, Remembering Theodore Roosevelt, featuring Steve Stark as Roosevelt. People often imagine that Theodore Roosevelt started the national park system, but it actually began much sooner. On this date, in 1872, President Ulysses S. Grant signed the Yellowstone National Park Protection Act into law. However, Roosevelt did create 5 national parks, doubling the number. And he's known as the Conservation President. He protected over 230 million acres of public land, setting aside 150 national forests, the 5 national parks, America's first 18 national monuments, the first 51 federal bird refuges, and our first game preserves. Roosevelt also initiated the United States Forest Service in association with friend and conservation mentor Gifford Pinchot, the nation's first professional forester. An insight into Roosevelt's moral character is how he often gave credit to those within his learning circle of experts and advisors.
Wise forest production does not mean the withdrawal of forest resources, whether of wood, water, or grass, from contributing their fair share to the welfare of the people. The fundamental idea of forestry is the perpetuation of forests by use. Forest production is not an end of itself. It is a means to increase and sustain the resources of our country and the industries which depend upon them. Gifford Pinchot is the man to whom the nation owes most of what has been accomplished as regards the preservation of the natural resources of our country. He was the foremost leader in the great struggle to coordinate all our social and governmental forces in the effort to secure the adoption of a rational and far-seeing policy for securing the conservation of all our natural resources. Among the many, many public officials who under my administration rendered literally invaluable service to the people of the United States, he, on the whole, stood first. Conservation and rural life policies are really two sides of the same policy, and at the bottom, this policy rests upon the fundamental law that neither man nor nation can prosper unless, in dealing with the present, thought is steadily taken for the future.
Today's Dakota Datebook was written and performed by Steve Stark. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the Historical Society of North Dakota. This series with funding from the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
No deal in North Korea. India-Pakistan tensions flare. Is the U.S. still any kind of global broker? And Albert Woodfox on 40 years in solitary for a crime he didn't commit.
There have been times when I've had attacks and I've walked up and down my cell and there were a puddle of water from the front of the cell to the back of the cell from me sweating.
Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
7 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Monday on Main Street, we'll talk about this upcoming statewide meeting by the North Dakota Council on the Arts. It happens late in March, and it will include the Governor's Awards for the Arts. We'll get a preview Monday from Kim Conoco, the Arts Council's Executive Director. And the State Historical Society will hold workshops on genealogy for Scandinavians later this month. The Society's Stephanie Baltzer-Kahm will join us to talk about that. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Monday, and we encourage you to check out Main Street Weekend, Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.